This is a podcast of the Political Ecology Forum at Norwegian University of Life Sciences. Visit politicalecology.space.
Today, for this Political Ecology Forum podcast, we have with us Alexander Dunlap, who will share with us academic insights regarding his experience with political ecology and how he uses political ecology in his research projects.
Yeah. I did my doctoral fieldwork looking at the impact of wind energy development in Oaxaca, Mexico, in the Isthmus of Tehuantepec region. And yeah, it was there that I began my formal academic work, doing fieldwork for a PhD in social anthropology. And yeah, so that's kind of where I realized that, you know, a lot of the solutions are actually huge and enormous problems for people on the ground, and specifically in this case, Akut and Zapotec people. And I think in this region was are kind of some of the first whistleblowers. You know, I think the Akut and Zapotec, they deserve credit for being some of the first whistleblowers over kind of the extent of the damages that can come from wind turbines and the different kind of political, economic, and cultural impacts they can have, and ecological. Because in this area, what was interesting is they're trying to build 102 wind turbines on the sandbar. And then just even beginning this, just the kind of the aquatic impacts on the marine life is like rather really crazy. Some of the testimonies and the stories, but then also nearby, they built the Bihiosho wind park, which is a wind park backed by Gas Natural Fenosa, Spanish natural gas company. That was the first wind park they were actually able to build on the lagoon there. But so I looked at wind energy development in Oaxaca. After that, my friend Andrea Brock, she invited me to look at coal mining in Germany, which was just south, and I had friends in the Humboldt forest occupation. So this was good. And we investigated RWE, which is one of the largest utility and like energy providers in Germany. And, but she was the lead on this, but we applied the lens of kind of counterinsurgency to kind of analyze the, what the company was doing and how it was trying to pacify resistance against coal mining. And after this was, I went and looked at copper mining in Peru at the, in the Valle de Tambo in Southwest Peru. And I was there based on invitation. And what was really interesting about the project is that Grupo Mexico was actually the main company behind it. And Southern Copper Peru was a subsidiary. And so when I was invited there and before I went, I looked into the project, and they also had wind parks in, this company also had wind parks, Grupo Mexico had wind parks in Oaxaca. And so for me, this was extremely interesting in looking at this connection of like, all right, not only is this company trying to green itself with its image and get on this renewable energy bandwagon, and mind you, I actually tried to find the specific mines, and it was very difficult, but these wind turbine projects by these mining companies, and there's also Penoles, Grupo Mexico and Penoles have between them three wind parks in Oaxaca, and it's actually going to power their operations, whether it's either mines or maybe their offices. And so not only was Southern Copper Peru / Grupo Mexico having wind parks in Oaxaca, but they've been trying to open a copper mine before I got there for 8 years previous to when I got there. And so for me, if you know anything about copper, this is a key conductor in electricity, instrumental for wind turbines, high tension power lines. And for example, for some of the direct drive turbines, no, sorry, not the direct drive, but ultimately the types of turbines that have less rare earth minerals in them, some of them need up to 3 tons of copper per wind turbine. So it's rather interesting to look at this company that was trying to green their image by being so-called renewable. And then I investigated that context, which was insanely violent, insanely rough, and it, a really coercive form of development. And meanwhile, you have the whole, I guess you could say, left celebrating low carbon infrastructures and saying it's green. You have environmentalists on this. And if you talk to indigenous people in these territories, and now really if any, a lot of French environmentalists, they would actually challenge this in a very strong way. So I looked at the Tia Maria conflict and got a lot of really intense and crazy information in terms of, you know, what the company was doing, the violent repression, the different kind of states of emergencies that were called, and flooding of the area of police to break strikes and to break the barricades because people were preventing the mine from coming in. And so to really see, like, you know, what does it take to get copper? What does it take to have energy infrastructure and wind turbines?
Yeah.
And Tia Maria is, in one sense, probably a more violent case, but it's certainly not it's certainly not alone. And yeah, it's horribly violent. And so, yeah, I've written papers about this. And then after that, I was invited to France to look at the construction of a large scale energy transformer. And again, the appeal of this was not only was there the local impacts that people were resisting, this transformer was an issue for not only itself being built, and how it's taking over and dispossessing farmland in Southwest France, but also how it was contributing locally to this rapid spread of wind turbines in the area and also solar projects when the area already was energy self-sufficient based on dams. Yeah. And so people began organizing and trying to resist it locally, but the big appeal that really stretched this past NIMBYism, you know, not in my backyard, is really understanding the collective and larger impacts of these kind of green capitalist projects. And specifically this transformer, not only was it instrumental to spread kind of wind turbines in these projects like the plague across the countryside, but it was a key infrastructure and a node within the high tension power lines and energy market. So this actually enabled the capacity locally, but also as an energy highway, where it was a 400,000 volt line that stretched way north up. You could trace it up into Finland and also way south, which you can trace down into Morocco and also into the Western Sahara region, which is officially one of the last colonies in Africa, as you say. So it's an area that's classically colonized by Morocco. And so the first years I looked at the specific impacts and the connections of the transformer. And then a year, 2 years later, I went back and began tracing all the different land conflicts related to this 400,000 volt line, attempting to connect it to Morocco and also the Western Sahara. But I was doing this field work and this multi-sided infrastructural field work during COVID. And that's kind of the last step I've been doing. I have articles and all sorts of work published about all this stuff. And then I'm currently working on lithium mining in Portugal. So really just been doing a lot of environmental conflicts, looking at the political and the ecological and the ecological and the political wherever I can.
That's very interesting. I see. Well, as you express how your work encounters the ecological and the political in this constant overlapping with each other, what would you say are the limitations or challenges of political ecology to be used in the field?
I think political ecology is the least limited in academia, you know? I think it's very much the most open and fluid and able to apply and to adapt to many different situations because it's very broad. But I think that question leads into, you know, what is academia? What's the point of academia? what role does it serve? What role does the university serve? And this changes a bit country to country, or at least from North America, South America, and Europe or Scandinavia. And then I can't even speak about, I don't even know, I can't say, speak to any other parts of the world or with universities. But I mean, like, what's the point of academia? And I mean, really, and how, what are we, where are we publishing? You know, all these corporate publishers, all these journals, really universities have rolled over and have let themselves be gutted thoroughly by the top five publishers. And then if you want to kind of be in academia, you need to be publishing in these places that are often behind paywalls if there isn't open access deals that have been created. So I don't know. I mean, I'm at a point where I see the role of academia being rather limited and or maybe ridiculous in terms of actually how it's actually contributing and helping to things. Obviously, education, learning, teaching, and having these discussions is really important, and having those things be there, having the kind of critical research that political ecology supports is fundamentally important. But at the same time, this comes to kind of deeper issues with teaching in terms of, you know, who's allowed to be in a university. What are the kind of the requirements for students to be in classes, especially in Scandinavia? You know, like what type of subjectivities, what type of experiences are students having before they're able to go in there? And in the case where I'm working, you know, the number one thing is grades. And for me, this is probably one of the worst criterias to be admitting people into universities in terms of actually having deeper conversations, having intrinsic motivation in terms of people's studies and their interests and things like this. So if there's any limitations in political ecology, I would see it based on the university system, how it's tied to kind of corporate publishing, you know, what are the kind of things that are being encouraged, also the weird kind of hierarchies and insecurities of different kind of professors and the weird hierarchies that go in there, which I think is related to just having this division of labor of the intelligentsia, which means that when your job becomes manifest, like, ultimately, there's probably not a more narcissistic and egotistic kind of thing you can be doing than be an academic. You know, you become, your whole process is commodifying yourself and also commodifying other struggles and things like this. And so what happens to you, you know, when you're really constantly focusing on your work, especially if it's violent conflict area stuff, the things that happen to you, the self-importance, and then no one really cares about these things. And you find out that you're publishing behind these paywall journals that are just wringing your labor out of you. And then, you know, the career climb and all these things that come with it. And then people who become, they lose ideas. They've just been bureaucratized, you know, where they, and then they start trying to steal ideas from their students, or they, you know, they lost creativity because of paperwork and all the horrible stuff. So I think the biggest problem with political ecology is the culture of the university and the corporate publishing that's been allowed to it. And if anything, political ecology is a breath of fresh air within it. Even, of course, I think there's lots of people and scholars who are trying to run under that name who I think don't honor that. And they are being kind of subsumed by kind of these sad and ill tendencies that are, you know, supported by our society and kind of the capitalist system.
These are very interesting reflections. And then I wonder, what could be a solution to avoid all this bureaucracy that you mentioned?
And how to avoid also this academic interference to make a real change out of political ecology reflection or analysis?
I mean, I have an answer, but I can't give it to you, you know? So I'm thinking of something a little more academic for you. If I can.
I think, but I'm reading your mind.
But I'll say it like this, you know, I think there's the greatest amount of responsibility for people who have established and tenured positions, people who are full professors, people who have ultimately been put through the meat grinder of bureaucracy and submission and taking orders and just the abusive bureaucratic loopholes and petty conflicts of administrators and people who are ultimately just sad and often bored people in a box together, trying to survive and do the things they want to do. And some people retain that passion and enthusiasm to kind of continue with their research topics or to be teaching the students or wanting to share these things with the students, when a lot of times, those things get crushed under the kind of the brick and mortar of every day of the university itself and its infrastructure, and also just the rest of industrial society or market society. So I think there's always possibilities, there's always hope, there's always ways to do things, but I think the change is going to really come from actually people really looking inward in themselves about who they are, what they're doing, and like what the university is and what they're actually contributing and making. And that's maybe the problem with being an academic, is maybe you're in, I mean, obviously there's an insane level of self-criticism, I think, for everyone. That's very difficult, but there at the same time, this can easily be matched with self-delusion or amplifying some small things in terms of the positive things that they do to make them seem like more, when in reality, I think there needs to be a reality check to really, you know, what these things are doing. And I think senior staff and people who are everyone really, but the people that have the greatest possibility to change things are going to be people who have established tenured positions. And I think it is going to be up to them to break down barriers between them and to begin organizing, to make departments that are going to be more, that I think are going to encourage more interactive learning as opposed to even passive learning, you know, and to do more hands-on and kind of radical in the sense of getting at the roots of these problems that we're talking about now. Where they live, where they work. So in their neighborhoods, where their families are, at their institutions and their universities, not somewhere else where they want to talk about Sami wind turbines, or they want to talk about oil in Ecuador, you know, or they want to talk about different armed groups in the Sahel or something like this. You know, I think it's really, well, of course, those things are interesting and important, but really having a concerted practice where you live and with your institution to actually make it socially and ecologically sustainable. And that means growing your own food on the lawn, having more agroecology and permaculture classes there, really trying to lead and live by an example where you are. And that means not using computers or Zoom or hyper digitalization and digital bureaucracies, which drives me crazy, and I know many others, to actually figure out how to create convivial technologies in our teaching, how to create more convivial teachings that are participatory and things like this. Mm. So I think the problems of political ecology are a lot of what it's been painted onto. And maybe we, and political ecology is a rebellion against positivist ecology and the apolitical ecology and ultimately the banal university environment. So I always see political ecology as a bit of a rebellion of this, but it can be extended. And I think people become very comfortable, especially in Scandinavian countries, in terms of their little niches and habits and things like this. And I think it's fundamentally important to begin transforming these things. Mm. And this is going to come from the people that are the safest and can rock the boat the most. And because a lot of times it's not even the full professors, but it's the people, it's the directors, it's the administrators, it's the rectors, it's things like this. And I think everyone needs to work together to really stop buying the green lies that are very, very comfortable and based on faulty arithmetic and accounting with bounded barriers, usually of the borders, and even faulty kind of metrics like carbon, which are very limited in terms of actually really seeing the extent of ecological degradation. Mm. So yeah, those are some thoughts that come to mind, but it's, these are a lot of barriers and this requires people doing a lot of internal work.
What is the potential that you see in political ecology to promote decolonial practices?
You know, decolonizing the university in this kind of talk is extremely relevant to political ecology, you know, not only with literal decolonial ecology being a thing kind of being articulated, but also with kind of decolonizing conservation and convivial conservation. So there is big overlap between political ecology and these conversations, and also efforts to, you know, for in general, I'm not satisfied with it at all. And I have an article that came out in Globalizations, part of a special issue on reimagining civilizations or something like this. But the article is called "I Don't Want Your Progress, It Tries to Kill Me." And it talks about, you know, anarchist encounters with decolonization. Mm. And for me, there's a really big difference between non-academic decolonial theory. So really specifically coming out of indigenous groups and usually indigenous anarchists themselves who are in struggle in North America or also in the Americas in general, I usually equate it to. And obviously there's the Fanon and the kind of the national liberation movements historically and ultimately the rearticulation. But when I think about these things, I really think about the Americas. And yeah, so there's the non-academic that I think is very much in tune with what's going on the ground. They are on the front line of kind of actually developing kind of this kind of theory and practicing it, and is very much tied up in deep collaboration with different kind of anarchists, indigenous or non-indigenous, who have been behind these movements for 10 or 15 years. You know, I'm thinking of Gord Hill, but there's so many others as well. And I've written a piece called where you can see a lot of the people cited in these areas. But so there's the non-academic who I think are great and amazing and we should listen to. But then there's the academic decolonial, which seem oddly, I mean, there's a lot of it's just coming out of Duke University Press books, volumes, volumes, volumes of things. And there's obviously good things in there. But when I hear people talking about decolonizing the university, I don't really see them being that serious. I don't really see people even knowing or wanting to identify what the colony is. Mm-hmm. So I see people preaching decolonize the university or decolonize in general, but they want the colony. They want the infrastructure. So for me, there's always been a big stake. And I work in critical genocide studies, where one of my earlier pieces looking at the impacts of wind turbines was to really ask, you know, what is the colony? And so this really has deep political stakes. And this also has deep stakes in terms of how you identify and relate to, you know, bureaucracy, capitalism, and different kind of infrastructures and the state and the economy. And so for me, it's very clear that the colony is just an advanced evolution of, or the state is just an advanced evolution of the colony. Yeah. So when we're talking about decolonized things, we have to ask what the colony is, what are its mechanisms of power? How does it work? How does it colonize? What is to be colonized? And, you know, I've been inspired by a lot of Native American scholars who were always laughing. I believe it was Ward Churchill, and they were speaking in Germany, and people were like, oh, how can we help you indigenous people in your struggle and all this? He's like, man, you got to help yourself. Your colonization is so consolidated and so thick, you can't even see the chains that are holding you down and things like this. I'm paraphrasing a bit. So it's the idea that to be a colonial power, you have to be able to internal colonize first, even to be even organize the conditions to colonize externally, you know? So this means that the state fundamentally is a process of, you know, governmentality, territorial control, and ultimately colonization. So what does that, so if you're coming at this, if really trying to break down what the colony is, really trying to figure out who this enemy is and what needs to be colonized, then if you, that's what's going to depend on how you look at it. So when we talk about decolonize the university, a lot of this to me has always sounded like more like affirmative action in the United States, where it's like, yeah, you got to have more kind of Latin American or people of color in your curriculum, you know, but it's ultimately a kind of a softening and or it's a more inclusive practice in terms of what exists within the university system. And of course, there should be more inclusion. Of course, there should be more diversity. Of course, there should be more participation. This is going to generate more ideas. It's going to be more interesting. But yeah, I don't know why people aren't talking about the linear layouts within classrooms and how we talk, or, you know, really what the purpose is and what people are being taught towards in terms of what the curriculum's teaching. You know, ultimately in Norway, it's just teaching you to go get a job in either some corporate NGO or government sector. You know, they're not really having deep conversations and certainly not teaching. And there's really practical things that can be done. And there's so many other ways to do things, but there's a very clear trajectory and train track that's not being questioned well enough. That is not being questioned well enough in my experience. And I think political ecology tries to question it. And I think it does. Many authors do very well, but I think there's also a lot of complicity. And that I think a big problem is that there's a lot of focusing on elsewhere and not really where you are. And it seems like as long as you have enough comfort, enough carrots, enough stability, then people are very quick to not bite the hand that feeds them. And realize that the hand that's feeding them is based on a whole process of dispossession, so people can't feed themselves.
Those are very interesting reflections. How would you say a perfect academic environment would look like?
A lot of why am I even here? I seem to be very critical. I seem to be rather discontent. Why am I even a part of this? Why do I have a doctorate? Why did I do these things? Why would I put myself through a disciplinary process, which in itself is going to be coercive, and trying to, you know, submit myself to internalize and understand an etiquette, a format, a discipline, you know? So why would I do this? And really is to understand, you know, the mess that I'm in. So I think a lot of motivations from people, obviously it's not the only one, is to really just understand the system, society they're in, and to understand it, and to what it is, and to understand possibilities, and to see different ideas. So obviously cultivating this, creating it so people can learn and understand the things they want to learn is, I think, the most important thing. And then to do that in a way that isn't fucking over other people. And when I say that, not just people, you know, different classes or ethnicities, but also rivers, trees, and animals and things like this. So how are you not destroying a land base? Think about how much is destroyed so we can have our really important academic Zoom calls. Think about how much is destroyed to just keep the power on, to keep cranking out whatever Elsevier is doing or Elsevirus is doing for the articles that we're publishing that are so important, you know? So it's like, how can we do this while creating harmony, not only with ourselves, but also with our environments? Like, how can we learn? How can we, because according to Robert E. Lane, there's roughly three things that lead to subjective well-being. And this is the sociological term for happiness. And that's literally your relationships, whether romantic or friendship, are fundamental to your happiness. And the second is education, the ability to learn. You know, these are, so the university is technically and should be a place instrumental for your happiness. And then the third is just the ability to make a choice, whether right or wrong, you know? So this is, this is from the book, The Loss of Happiness and Markets Democracy, is written, I don't know, 15 years ago or something. But so there's probably more work on this, but the university should be cultivating this. And so, like I already said, man, we should be growing food up the, we should be growing food in our departments. We should be up the walls inside. We should be brewing our own beer and making our own wine. We should be, everything should be green and fun. There should be animals. Like, we should be having it, you know, really gaining as much power as we can from the buildings that we're in, not destroying places in other areas, whether they're for dams or for wind turbines or for coal plants. And then, you know, people are talking about nuclear again, like this is fun, like this is okay and funny, like they know anything about uranium mining and processing.
Yeah.
So, you know, really how to just Yeah, how to be able to learn, how to support each other, and how to live without destroying each other and the planet that we and the ecosystems that we live in, or ecosystems further away.
Hmm.
So I think that's where academia should go.
What are then the links between political ecology and anarchy? Would you say that it could be a way of giving anarchy a better publicity through calling it political ecology?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've always interpreted political ecology as being really being anarchist in terms of really looking at kind of anti-authoritarian relationships and how that works. I did a little bit of a literature review on this in the Violent Technologies of Extraction in like chapter 3 that kind of looks and compares critical agrarian studies and political ecology. And so there's a bit of a review there. But ultimately, I think the big anarchist influences in political ecology are kind of one, and Paul Robbins does this, despite Paul, who I get to see in a couple of weeks, despite not really understanding or caring for degrowth, he actually gave and has given probably the most credit to anarchists, or specifically Peter Kropotkin, for their influence on political ecology. And so, you know, Peter Kropotkin has been a huge underlying influence implicitly in political ecology. And before that, LSE Recluse, who doesn't get much credit, is another huge influence on political ecology. Another who people don't really realize is that ultimately Michel Foucault more or less academicized a lot of anarchist ideas, and specifically developed the ideas of Max Stirner, who is famous for, you know, the book, The Unique and Its Property. Who really associated with individualist anarchism, which was really the most dangerous and insurrectionary in terms of how it approached society, in terms of how people are individually being dominated and allow themselves to be dominated. And yeah. Foucault really developed this with his kind of really developing the concepts that came out of that, of the prison society, and also developing within this, the, you know, there's a chapter in that book called My Intercourse. And ironic, but it's talking about society a bit, but it's ironically, you know, Foucault's was big focus with sex in terms of actually the analysis of disciplinary power and biopower and things like this. So Foucault has this, and I mean, not to mention his political activity in terms of, you know, being at, you know, fighting police in the 50s and also supporting, you know, the lawyers of kind of urban guerrillas in the 70s. But he's an anarchist, if not anarchist, and a huge anti-authoritarian influence on political ecology. And there's a bunch of links there. And then third and finally is Ivan Illich, is someone who made his way, I mean, mostly through post-development. I mean, the whole school of post-development more or less comes from and was initiated by Ivan Illich, and the way that he just watched he just watched what development was doing. And so with Gustavo Esteva and Arturo Escobar. And Escobar, again, combining Illich and Foucault, you know, brought these things forward. And again, Illich was saying similar things Foucault was saying. Illich was saying things in 3 pages that Foucault would say in a book, you know? So yeah. There's a really deep and fundamentally kind of anti-authoritarian and anarchist influence in there. And then again, the more obvious one, and a question I've always had for myself, is there's Marie Bookchin's social ecology. And it's kind of interesting why political ecology didn't just call itself social ecology. And there's maybe some kind of branding overlap there, but political ecology was the more academic. And then you can say, you know, more trying to be more apolitical than say social ecology, even though political ecology was a reaction against the real positivism and apolitical ecology.
Yeah.
So lots of ecology, but yeah, so I've always interpreted political ecology as being really fundamentally anti-authoritarian and influenced by anarchism. And it is to a degree, but at the same time, more from the academic side, Marxism has been a big influence as well. But yeah. And there's many different types of Marxism, but I definitely see political ecology as being more anarchist. And now there's anarchist political ecology, because academia loves making new labels to put on things and to diversify products, as they say in economics.
Of course, the commodification of knowledge. But now, to wrap up this very enriching interview, tell me, what is Sander Dunlap doing right now? What you're up to, and And thank you again for taking part of this Political Ecology Forum podcast.
Yeah, oof, I have so many projects and I'm about to be done with my job and have no money. So I'm doing job applications. I'm a little burnt out. Mm-hmm. I haven't really been able because of having a lot of stuff in my life related to moving and stuff like this. So I haven't been up on my grants, dealing with being screwed over. But yeah, I've been looking at lithium mining in Portugal. So I'm looking at with Mariana, a great PhD student. We're looking at the making in the beginning of the European Union trying to make one of the largest open pit lithium mines in Europe. And so this is to really look at the reality of e-mobility or in electric vehicles and smart sensors and also energy storage technologies, is this being a pathway to be green and ecologically sustainable, which too many adults, too many well-educated people are very quick to believe in these things. And I guess that's the scary thing, is that, you know, none of this stuff is about helping the environment. None of this is about climate change mitigation. This is all about, you know, saving and expanding kind of capitalist or technological innovation and ultimately the kind of the state system and its economy. Mm. But so yeah, I've been looking at kind of the horrors that will come from open pit lithium mining. Super depressing, very sad in terms of, yeah, I mean, mining is water. If you value water, if you drink water, if you want clean ecosystems and the web of life from the different bees and dragonflies that are kind of in the areas around here, it will be destroyed. Mm. And yeah, I'm also, for Pluto, I'm writing a book that's kind of reflecting on the last, which by the time it comes out, will probably be the last 10 years of my 10 years of environmental conflicts, which is like, wow. Depending on, I mean, there's probably 7 big ones, but if you look at the ones in between with looking at the power line, there's probably been 9 environmental conflicts that I've worked in and have worked with the movements and did everything I can to kind of generate knowledge to better understand how companies are working and how ultimately climate crisis and ecological crisis continues, despite all this popular rhetoric the last 5 years about it being a problem. So yeah, writing a book, and yeah, just, I've got a series of talks coming up. I'm being flown to the US to give talks at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'll be giving a couple there and just trying to get all my stuff done, finish my writing. There's some cool articles coming out. There's a lot of things like this. Yeah, in environmental policy and science, I'm really happy about an article coming out called Green Economy is Counterinsurgency. Mm-hmm. Or the ontological foundations of permanent ecological catastrophe. So really looking at, yeah, it's a wordy one.
Yeah.
But really looking at the foundations to what justifies the green economy and kind of the mess we're in and the resulting climate reductionism. So yeah, lithium mining, book, and just trying to clean up different writing projects and things like this. And yeah, looking for work. Looking for formal affiliation.
Well, we are out of time, and I'm very grateful for your contribution and participation. And now to the audience, don't forget to follow our podcast in Spotify and other platforms. Thank you for staying with us.